The young athletes of Toms River were celebrated in the 1990s when the town's Little League baseball team competed in the Little League World Series 3 times in 5 years. That acclaim, though, was muted by headlines noting a seemingly high number of childhood cancer cases in the New Jersey community. That story is told by Dan Fagan in Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And his book, which came out last March, this week received the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction. Fagan is an associate professor of journalism and the director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University. Mr. Fagan, congratulations, and thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you very much, Dave.
1 year on, what has changed for Toms River and this issue at large?
Well, Toms River, the cleanup has continued. They'll be pumping contaminated groundwater at the Toms River site for at least another decade. That's the downside. But on the upside, there's no reason at all to think that Toms River is an unsafe place to live. In fact, there's every reason to think that the air and the water in Toms River is probably a little bit safer. And the reason is because so much attention has been given to this issue in town.
But that does little for those who were victims of these cancer clusters.
That's true. And the big reason I wrote this book was that I think the tragic events that unfolded in Toms River over a 50-year period, they're a cautionary tale. There are things that all of us can learn from. But really, the wrong attitude to take would be to say, oh, poor Toms River, isn't it awful that happened there? The right attitude to take, I think, would be to think carefully about what happened in Toms River and apply those lessons to our own communities.
And indeed, many readers cite the more universal aspects of it, and it seems to be in part the nexus of commerce and the profit motive coming up against regulation or lack thereof.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people have asked me, who are the bad guys in this book? And I really don't think of it that way. You know, I think of human beings acting, according to the way that human beings act. We're not very good at anticipating the long-term consequences of our short-term behaviors. We're immediate thinkers. We're not long-term thinkers. And the way to deal with long-term consequences is to really to set up a network of laws and regulation that functions effectively. And we certainly didn't have that in Toms River for a very long time. And I think there are many things about the way we have written and enforce our environmental laws that are sadly lacking.
If we, on the global level, invoke the term NIMBY, not in my backyard, we certainly get products from China and India, and there are rife examples of the same kind of catastrophes playing out in those nations.
That's exactly right, Dave. And that, again, that's a crucial reason why I wrote this book. I do think that, as frustrating as it can be, I do think that human beings are capable from learning from the past. And I'm hoping that my book will be a part of that. And I must say that process is happening right now. I look very proud and happy when the Chinese language rights to this book sold last year, because I want the message of this book to be read in China. I want it to be read in India. And I also want it to be read in the United States, because, as you point out, we are a part of this cycle because of our demand for consumer products that, we're happy to enjoy the benefits of as long as we don't have to face the consequences of how they're made.
Mr. Fagan, you served as president of the 1,500-member Society for Environmental Journalists. What's your reaction to polling that continues to show a significant skepticism about man's part in global warming?
I've looked really carefully at those numbers, and I know they're often presented that way, but a solid two-thirds of Americans understand what the science says. I mean, it's just basic physics. Not accepting the basic atmospheric chemistry of the greenhouse effect and the role that man-made greenhouse gas emissions play in that is tantamount to not accepting Newtonian physics, the laws of gravity. And most Americans do accept those laws. Then those that don't, I think, are afraid that it's not that they're afraid of the science. What they're really afraid of are the consequences that go along with, what does it mean if we're altering the Earth's chemistry, if we're warming the planet, well, what kind of draconian measures do we have to take in order to deal with that? And that's frightening to people. They're frightened about the role of what role government might play, and they're also frightened about how their own lifestyles may change. And I completely understand that. And you know, that's why accepting the science is very important, but even more important, whether you are willing to acknowledge the reality of the science, even more important is that all of us collectively try to figure out effective ways to deal with controlling greenhouse gas emissions and also adjusting to life on a warming planet. That's an urgent task, and we all need to face it and stop wasting time arguing about the science. That's not what matters. What does matter is, what are we going to do about this problem?
And to the extent that we look to lawmakers to create those regulations, politicians, of course, are afraid of being booted out of office, and they're looking to their next election cycle. With those short-term parameters, how can we look to the system to look at long-term solutions?
Well, you've put your finger on the critical problem, that our democracy is wonderful in many ways, but it is not good at grasping and dealing with long-term problems, because politicians, being people, are focused on the short-term, and their short-term priority is getting reelected every 2 years or every 6 years or, you know, whatever the term is. I do think, Dave, that one really important thing that we can do is to do everything we can to try to reduce the role of special interest funding in politics, whether that funding comes from industry or from labor, from individuals, from corporations. And I always say that for people who are concerned about a whole host of environmental issues, like the ones I wrote about in Tom's River or climate change, as you referred to, the most important thing that all of us can do is to support true campaign finance reform, because if we can't reduce the role of special interest money in the political system, we are never going to be able to come up with sensible, creative, long-term solutions to these problems.
But given human nature and the way it's continuing to play out, as we've cited in, say, for example, China, I'm curious about the subtitle. You invoke the phrase salvation. I looked it up. It implies deliverance from sin and its consequences. How did you determine that word?
Right. Well, we thought about that word a long time, I'm still not certain it's exactly the right word, but I did think it was really important to signal to readers that this is a story about citizens that woke up, that made a difference in their communities, and that this book is not only a cautionary story about what can go wrong, it's also very much a primer on what we can do right. Because when the people of Toms River, led by a few brave families and a few outsiders, some of them from Philadelphia, by the way, under the leadership of those people, the town eventually awoke to what was happening around them. And it took a very long time, and there was far too much tragedy along the way. But eventually, Toms River became a much safer place to drink the water and breathe the air. And that would not have happened if its residents had not woken up to the responsibilities of citizenship, as they did.
Tragically, many of those families, as you said, met in Philadelphia and New York when they brought their children to medical facilities in those towns.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I describe the situation in the book. There's a wonderful woman named Lisa Bornazian, who's from the Philadelphia area, and she was a nurse in the pediatric oncology ward at CHOP, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And she noticed what appeared to be a lot of patients from Toms River, and she was met with a lot of skepticism from other people on the ward, from physicians and others. But she would not let it drop, and she had has a sister-in-law, worked for the Environmental Protection Agency, and the two of them eventually found the right person to talk to, and eventually that led to an investigation. Well, that investigation, the results of it were initially made secret, covered up, you could say. But eventually the word did get out, and that in turn triggered a kind of an amazing process that eventually led to a fascinating scientific result and a much cleaner Toms River.
Much cleaner. When you cited the chemical industry coming to that central Jersey town in 1952, I believe you said 4 million pounds of finished product also produced 18 million pounds of hazardous chemical waste.
Yeah, that's correct, at that time. know, dyes, but we don't think of dyes as a very important product, but there would be no chemical industry and no, therefore no petrochemical industry if it weren't for dyes. Dyes were the first great product of the industrial age, at least the chemical industrial age. And the thing about dye manufacturing, especially as it was done back then, is it generates a tremendous amount of waste, absolutely tremendous. And one of the reasons the company went, came to Toms River is that there was plenty of space, there was sandy soil, so whatever you dumped onto the sand, it just sort of disappeared. Of course, it didn't actually disappear. It entered groundwater with very serious consequences. And they put a lot into the river. And the Toms River is not a mighty river like the Rhine back in Basel, where this chemical company started. Toms River was a small stream. And eventually the pollution became quite obvious, and the company's solution was, well, let's build a pipeline and dump the waste in the ocean instead. And that was classic short-term thinking. It pleased the town, at least some people in the town, but it just moved the problem elsewhere.
Did SEBA in parts elect Toms River because of its relative anonymity compared to either the Rhine or Cincinnati? Mm-hmm.
Well, that certainly the documents that I examined certainly suggest that it was a very important factor. It was isolated. There was plenty of room. There was a water source nearby because the company needed water to manufacture dyes, and it also needed water and water source to dump its wastewater. So all of those factors were important, and I tell that story of the site selection based on a lot of difficult document work that I put together over the years, and it's quite a fascinating story.
And amazing, perhaps is not the word, but incredible to learn that the disposal methods in the mid-20th century scarcely advanced from those 100 years previously.
Yeah, that's true. In essence, they had not changed much. You know, in the 50s, SEBA was still basically doing open pit dumping. Some of the pits had concrete lining, some of them didn't. It took a long time. Eventually, the company shifted to dumping into a lined landfill and then eventually a double-lined landfill. But even in the double-lined landfill, there were leaks and there were problems. You know, there were issues involving illegal disposal as late as the 1970s. I should say, too, that you know, we've been talking a lot about this one chemical plant, but equally serious, maybe even more serious in terms of the effect on the water supply, was an illegal dump elsewhere in town that contaminated another set of wells, different than the wells that the company had contaminated in the 50s and 60s. These wells were contaminated starting in the 70s and 80s, and even in certain ways on into the 90s. So there was a lot happening in Toms River, and it would be wrong to lay the blame solely on the dye company, on SEBA. There were other things that were happening, too.
Lastly, Mr. Fagan, though you do regard this as a cautionary tale, do you believe it's a matter of if rather than when the next, whatever, Bhopal, Love Canal, Toms River, or Fukushima accident takes place?
We shouldn't focus only on the so-called disasters, the ones that get all the attention. What we should really do is think about the risks that we confront every day. And we need aggressive, robust government monitoring and oversight and enforcement to minimize those risks. Environmental problems are not just about the handful of disasters that catch all the attention. Most environmental risk is much more every day. It can be the dry cleaner down the block, or it could be the cleaning products you use in your home. We need to be smart about these things at all levels.
Mr. Fagan, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's been my pleasure.
Dan Fagan is the author of Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. The book this week received the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction.